Hey guys, it's Candace.
And it's Elena.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. Welcome back to part two.
Are you ready for this?
Are you? Are you ready for
I'm
this,
I'm ready.
Okay. I don't know if you are, but let's just jump right into it because I got a lot of notes.
Okay. Come on.
So in part one, we learned a lot about a guy named John Smith. If you haven't listened to part one, go listen to that first and come back for the conclusion of the story. So John was being investigated by the FBI for the disappearance of not one, but two of his wives. And his new wife, Diane, couldn't bring herself to really believe that the man she knew could have been involved in any way. Fran's family, though, was a big help when it came to learning certain details about John's past for the investigation and for bringing Diane around to the truth.
They hired a private investigator. And because my mom was working, I was supposed to go around with the private investigator and watch John. And then soon after that is when I met Fran's family and we went through our storage unit.
The storage unit.
Oh, wow.
Now, this is a storage unit that John shared with his new wife, Diane. Surely he's not keeping any damning evidence in there, right? Like,
I mean, was Diane's, were her things in there as
well?
Yeah,
it was both of their stuff.
Okay.
My mom always kept the keys and she handled all the finances when it came to that storage unit. So we were able to go through that storage unit with Fran's family and look for stuff on John. It was a really, really hot day, and there was a suitcase in there. And I said, well, this isn't my mom's suitcase. This isn't my family's suitcase. This must be John. So I pulled it out, and I opened it, and we found some pictures of some women from, like, it looked like from the 70s, maybe early 80s. So it wasn't Jan. It wasn't Fran. Jan's the first wife. Fran's the second wife. And it wasn't them, so we held on to those. And then I found a piece of paper with a resume, and it said he put on his resume he worked for NASA. I'm all, really? You know, and he's working at an Italian car monster Miata thing. Okay. And then we found some other paperwork with dates on it. And supposedly, that paperwork put John in the same area in the same time frame that the first wife Jan's body was found on the side of the road.
Ah.
Ooh.
Jan's body.
So they found her.
Yeah. We'll get to that.
Okay.
We'll get to that. But first, let's talk about the investigation into Fran's disappearance, which was the impetus, really, for uncovering everything else.
Mm-hmm.
He had been up to. When Fran first married John back in the early 90s, she told her daughter Dee Dee about this beautiful coastal home that John owned up in Connecticut that his sister was living in. Now, Fran had always wanted to go visit this home, you know, like get away. But there was always these excuses why they couldn't go. Oh, my sister's not there this weekend, or she is there this weekend, or, you know, she's got company. But unbeknownst to Fran, John was visiting that house on the regular.
Oh.
Yeah. So after Fran went missing in 1991, Dee Dee and her Aunt Sherry were wondering if that house in Connecticut maybe held any clues as to where Fran was or what happened to her. But it didn't.
Hmm.
Instead, it opened a whole new can of worms. They went up to Connecticut.
I love them.
I know. I know. They went up to Connecticut and they parked outside this house that John's sister was living in just to scope it out, just to see what they could see. And they saw this woman coming and going. And the only problem was that in their digging, they learned that John had two brothers, but he didn't have a sister.
I knew
he
you
did
were going to say that.
He did not have a sister. So who was the woman living in that house? To find out, you're going to love this. This is something you and I are going to do in our PI business. Dee Dee called the house under the guise that she was a contractor looking to fix damaged homes in the area after a local storm had gone through.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. So she calls and this woman answers and she goes, Mrs. Smith? The lady on the other end goes, yes. Dee Dee completes the ruse, but this Mrs. Smith, I'm using air quotes here, said, no, we didn't get any damage, but, you know, thanks for calling.
Yeah.
Of course, Dee Dee and Cherry immediately call the detectives because they're like, he's got another wife over here.
Yeah.
Like, what?
This is not his sister.
Come on. So when detectives went to the home, because, you know, they're just going to walk up to the door and knock on the door because they're detectives. And they learned that the lady living there in the home was named Sheila. And it was John's longtime girlfriend of 8 years.
Okay.
Yeah. So he'd been dating Sheila for 8 years. He meets and marries Fran.
How long was he married to Fran?
Like
not
less
long.
Than a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they weren't married, but they had talked about getting married. And, you know, Sheila knew that John traveled a lot for work.
Oh,
so he was
no.
gone a lot. Yeah. They brought Sheila into the local station to talk to her. And it was there that she learned that her boyfriend, John, was actually married to some woman who was missing.
Oh, my gosh.
Can you imagine, like,
her, bless her heart.
I know. She was a wreck. She just thought John traveled a lot. She didn't imagine that he was living a double life.
Or like a quadruple
life.
Right.
But that was the least of her worries because they're like, the wife is missing. So they asked if she would call John right then and there so they could listen and record the conversation to see if maybe he'd confide in her about anything or just say anything or slip up about anything or reveal something new that they could use. And she agreed. So in the call, she asked John about Fran. She said, do you have a wife that's missing? where is she, John? What happened to her? Is she dead?
Ugh.
And he's like, no. Well, I don't know. Probably.
Probably.
Yeah. He didn't admit anything to Sheila. He dodged all her questions, knowing full well that the detectives had been to see her.
Yeah.
You know, and they were probably still in communication with her. Then Sheila brought up Janice and her disappearance.
Oh.
And he was like, yeah, I had no idea actually that Janice was missing until recently because no one told me all this time. I never knew.
Okay, right.
Yeah.
Nobody believes you.
Around the time Janice went missing, he left Ohio and moved away.
Well, why did he
leave? Isn't that convenient?
Yeah.
But he claims that, oh, he was gone. No one, his brother didn't call him. No one called him. Their friends didn't call him.
How dare they?
Yeah. And surely people were looking for her. So wouldn't they call John?
Right.
Her recently ex-husband? Now, he made it sound like the relationship ended and he lost touch with her. Mm-hmm. And oh my God, she's missing? The recorded phone call didn't work. You know, he played dumb. He was an expert at this. Been there, done that. And he maintained he didn't know anything about what happened to Fran or Jan.
Yeah.
The police investigated Fran's disappearance for about a year, but they hit a brick wall. I mean, they had no evidence that John had done anything to Fran or that she was even dead. You know? Yeah.
No body, no crime.
Well, yeah. But that didn't stop Dee Dee and Sherry from investigating.
Go for it,
they
girls.
They were relentless. I mean, you think of police investigators, they're trying to do things by the book. They're trying to operate within the confines of the law. Make sure that they don't slip up so that everything can be used in court.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that these ladies were not, or like they were committing a crime, but they don't have
to
abide.
Limited,
right. Yeah. They're not limited to this. So they were like, we'll do whatever we have to do. So they kept in contact with John, you know, who was moving around, changing jobs. Entirely unfazed that Fran never returned home from this trip that she left a note saying she was going on. Dee Dee and Sherry wrote a letter directly. This is so good. They find out where he works, like this new job he's got. They wrote a letter to the receptionist and they're like, watch out. Watch out for this guy.
Whoa.
And they included a missing persons flyer for Fran.
Wow.
Yeah.
What if he intercepted the letter?
Yeah, I don't know that he would have. I mean, big, you know,
big
wigs, they don't handle the mail. Us little peons handle the mail, you know. But he wasn't able to get too comfortable in one place because of this.
Yeah.
And he had to keep bouncing around. Now, years began to pass. Years. Dee Dee wondered, where's my mother? Where is John?
Mm-hmm.
What's happening with this case? Is anybody even investigating? John continued to move around, not really staying in one place for long. And an FBI agent named Bob Hillen latched on to this like catch me if you can John character. He was a special agent and remembered these two women that went missing. And he was like, whatever happened with that?
Mm.
Like, the two women that went missing? And it's like, he's like, we're not doing anything with that or what? Now, it's not common for the FBI to work on a case of this nature. Like,
okay, yeah.
With, you know, missing persons, almost. You know what I mean? Like, the crossing state lines, like, it does seem like the FBI might get involved in that. But there was no evidence of any
attachment.
Crimes.
Okay.
Yeah. So he promised his boss, look, this will not interfere with my daily tasks or workload. Like, just let me work on this on the side. And after getting the go-ahead, he spent every bit of his spare time looking into John.
Wow, what a special guy.
Yeah. Special Agent Hilland, who I'll henceforth refer to as Bob, discovered that 5 years after Fran went missing, John was arrested for driving with a suspended license, which dang. They arrested him for driving with a suspended license.
Uh-huh.
They had no idea. Well, when they booked him, the police, for whatever reason, copied a photo of a woman that was in John's wallet. Maybe they thought she was beautiful and they were like,
what?
I want a copy of this. I don't know, but it was in the file.
I
love it. It's weird, but I love it.
I do too.
Okay.
Like, just the inkling that maybe we should.
Isn't that strange? Like, I've never heard of such a.
That gets me. Yeah.
I know. It's wild. They didn't know who this person was, but they just copied this picture, put it in the case file. So Bob sees this photo, this copied photo of the woman. And down in the corner with a metallic gold emblem, it says Glamour Shots. Now, we heard Summer reference Glamour Shots earlier, and if you youngins don't know what Glamour Shots is, this was before we had self-facing cameras, and people would get all gussied up at the mall And
I mean, surely your grandma or your nana or your Mimi has one.
Sure. Our moms have them. And with their permission, we will post it on our stories. Your mom's going, no.
No.
My mom's going, no. But maybe we will. Anyway, he sees this Glamour Shots emblem down in the bottom of this picture. And he's like, you know what? I'm just going to go for it. So he goes to the mall to Glamour Shots.
That's awesome.
What? No way he's going to find this the person in this photo.
I mean, because how many Glamour Shot studios are there?
And they all look the same. All these women are the same. You know what I mean? Like, how in the world? They found the woman in the photo.
No way.
Yes, they did. Yes,
impressive.
They did.
Good record keeping.
This is gumshoe stuff.
Love it.
Now, Bob flew to New Hampshire to meet with this woman. This woman, who remains unnamed, was very upset to see him.
Oh.
She cried.
Oh, no.
As she told Bob that she'd been having an affair with John.
Oh, no.
She was married. She had a new baby. And she'd really only see John every month or so, like probably when he was traveling for work, quote unquote. And then mentioned that despite the fact that he now lives in California, they carried on speaking over the phone. And she was actually making plans to leave her husband and take her baby and join him in California.
Oh, no.
So they're like, California, you say? Yeah. She told Bob that at one point she hadn't spoken to John in a couple of weeks. Like, she couldn't get a hold of him. She'd call him. He wouldn't answer. He wouldn't call her back. She'd leave messages. No returned calls. She reached out to one of his work colleagues. And they're like, oh, yeah, he's out with Diane right now. They're shopping for their wedding.
Oh.
This is, we're coming back to Diane now.
Right.
So, yeah. So he was dating this woman long distance. She finds out he's getting married to someone. And she was crushed.
After she's about to
move. She was like, wait a minute. He's engaged, but we're planning to get married. She was heartbroken.
Oh.
And she was about to blow up her life.
Yeah.
For this guy. Take her baby and leave her husband. She was stunned.
The grass is not always greener on the other side.
Oh, no. Definitely not. So now we're back to the beginning of the story. Diane and John meet and they get married. Now, these relationships he had just blended into each other, overlapped, smeared into one another. How did he keep all these women straight?
How?
Like, how did he not call them the wrong name? But you know what? Even if he had called them the wrong name, it feels like it might have gone unnoticed. Like,
sure.
He would have manipulated or twisted or been like, oh, you know what? Frida is a lady I work with.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just, I've called you Frida.
Yeah.
I just made up the name Frida because I don't know who a Frida is. But anyways, so Bob learns about another impending marriage and he felt like, okay, I've got to find John because he's about to get married again.
Oh,
and like, man. We know what he does when he gets married. These women seem to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Bob was up to his eyelashes in this case. He knew John had something to do with Janice and Fran. He just couldn't prove it. And no matter how hard he looked, it's like he couldn't grab onto one thing. It was like every little thing was slipping through his hands. What started out as a side project within the parameters of his current role at work became an obsession, really.
Mm.
He told Dateline that he almost lost his job and his wife over this case because it consumed him.
Well, it would have to. Like, you just, how do you compartmentalize all of that?
That's it. it takes a special kind of person to be a nurse. Yeah. It takes a special kind of person to be an investigator, because you have to have the stamina.
Right.
Like you say, to compartmentalize things.
Yeah.
But he wasn't going to wait for another wife to disappear and have one more thing to investigate. He's like,
honey, I have to save these people.
Yeah. In part one, we talked about how the FBI was watching John for a while Diane had no idea. I mean, she didn't notice, you know, the same car sitting outside or anything like that, but they were watching them. And after years of hopping around, they finally found him in California with Diane, and they weren't going to lose him again.
Good.
So it wasn't long after finding John that Special Agent Hilland and a group of investigators put their plan into action. They traveled to California and confronted John in the parking lot of his job, this high-end car company, and said, "We're here from out of town. We're staying at a hotel just down the way. Would you like to come back with us and speak with us?" And John's like, "About what?" And they're like, "Oh, you're missing wives. Uh-huh. We just want to talk to you about that."
Yeah. We're sure you can have some insight.
Yeah. I mean, tell us, because we don't know. And John's like, "I mean, okay, I'll go with you." Because he's smart. He's so smart. Mm-hmm. If they had any evidence against him, and he knew this, if they had anything, they would have just cuffed him right there.
Ah.
They didn't have anything on him. He was fine. He wasn't the slightest bit worried. And John may have been smart, but Bob was smarter.
Uh-huh.
They brought John into this hotel room, and they sat him down at this table. And on the wall where he's facing, John couldn't help but notice this, you know, diagram of sorts that they had created on the wall.
Wow.
It was a photo of him and then like a wagon wheel almost surrounding his face were people's pictures.
Oh.
His brother, his, you know, people from his past, people he knew, with arrows pointing from John to each of these people.
He's like, oh, they might know more than...
Like, he's just looking at it and they're like, "What do you think all these people have in common, John?" And John said, "Well, they're people I know." And Agent Hillen said, "Yeah, that could be. Or it could be that they're all simultaneously being interviewed right now by the FBI.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
And that would have been a real line if he was lying, but he was not lying. He really did have agents all over interviewing people that knew John and reporting back to them.
That's awesome.
In the room adjacent to them. So, the questioning began, you know, they're sitting in there talking. They wasted no time trying to trip him up over his own words. They brought up that phone call with Sheila, his longtime girlfriend that they found out about. And they confronted him with this flippant way that he figured Fran was probably dead. You know, he wasn't sure. And he was like, "I didn't say any of that. I didn't say any of that." And they're like, "Roll that beautiful bean footage." So they bring out the tape recorder and they're like, "Let me refresh your memory." So they press play and he can be heard admitting to lying in his polygraph.
Ooh.
Yeah. He told Sheila, "Yeah, I lied in my polygraph." And he's just sat at the table, shrugged his shoulders like, "And?"
Oh, like what?
"Okay, you caught me in a lie, but I didn't admit to anything." And they knew that. They were like, "Yeah, I mean, and?" So for, you know, more questioning goes on. Then this piece of yellow paper folded gets slipped under the crack of the door. It's news from the field agents. Michael's brother is talking.
Oh.
It's warming up.
Okay.
Remember that detective that previously questioned John's brother, Michael, all those years ago when Grandma kicked him out?
Yeah.
Well, that same detective went back.
Okay.
To interview him again.
When Grandma wasn't there?
Well, I don't know if she was there or not, but it was a smart move because Michael seemed like reluctant witness already. And so to send back the same investigator that had already established,
okay,
you know, had already seen him one time. So someone in the room picks up this piece of yellow paper that was just slid under the door. And I don't know who, you know, or how they delivered the news, or if that person was like, well, 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 your brother's over there singing like a canary, you know, that's probably what I would have said. I don't know if they really played it up, but suddenly John starts having these faux chest pains.
Oh, my goodness.
And then he fakes a heart attack.
Okay, dude.
He's like, oh, I can't go on with this questioning. I need to go to the hospital. So they called EMS. EMS checks him out. All his readings, all his vitals are completely normal.
Fine, yeah. Oh, gosh.
Imagine that.
Get over and it.
They're like, oh, you're fine. John is like, no, I need to go to the hospital. And with that, John was wheeled away to freedom once again.
They didn't, like, go with him?
No.
Like, have someone sit outside the room?
I mean, that's the thing is, like, you think of a dangerous criminal. Like, you think of times when they handcuff someone to the bed or
right.
a
stretcher. Of course they didn't have them arrested.
They didn't have. That's the thing is, like, they had everything and nothing all at once.
But go they to the hospital. Don't this. Let them get out. And
I know. I know. Now, here's where our timelines start to intersect. After confronting John in that hotel room, they introduce themselves to John's new wife, Diane.
Okay.
Throughout the investigation, Diane stayed with John, even though Fran's family and Special Agent Hilland were encouraging her to leave. Mm-hmm. Like, you got to get out of here. She felt like it might be better to have eyes on John and know his comings and goings rather than be anxious. Like, if she left, she felt like she might be in more danger if she left. Luckily, Summer didn't know at the time, but police did have protective detail on Diane. And Diane wasn't a dummy. You know, after much encouragement from Bob, she came up with a plan to leave safely. She just needed to be strategic about it.
Yeah, she knows his patterns and all that. So.
Exactly.
My mom was very ridiculed for that, for staying with him. But we actually helped by her staying with him and us knowing his pattern. We helped the case to bring him to justice a lot more than what we were given credit for, you know, and thank God we weren't killed or she wasn't killed. There was things said like she stayed with him just for the money. He gave her a Ferrari. But no, we were out there gathering information, what we could.
So at this time, after learning all this stuff, Summer had moved in with her mom and John in their little condo that they were living in. It was like a townhome or a like an apartment. It made Diane feel safer thinking that someone else was there. You know, if someone else was there, he wouldn't do anything to her. You know, after all, he wore so many different masks with different people. And so he had never been a certain way around Summer, you know, and he'd never been a certain way around her either.
Mm-hmm.
I asked Summer if she was at all scared during that time that she was living with John.
Because she had little babies, too.
Well, yeah. And actually, I'm not sure if at the time they had moved in. I think that her son was living with them at the time in that front bedroom.
Okay.
But she told Dateline that she really wasn't scared of him because they felt like if he only kills when someone leaves him and if my mom doesn't leave him, you know, she's safe and I'm safe because I'm not his wife. I'm not leaving him. You know, it was like a certain dynamic. So Summer said that she became like a bodyguard to her mother and a detective. Her and her mom would look through his stuff when he was gone to work to try and find anything that could be of use, anything related to Fran or Janice or Ohio, Connecticut, New Jersey, or anywhere else they had known him to be or be with.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in late 1999, Agent Hilland had to return to New York City. You know, here's something we don't always think about, you know, like logistics. When an FBI agent is investigating a case and they have a workload, they can't just go camp out in California. Yeah. You know, like they have a life back home, and he had to report back to work.
Yeah.
I mean,
juggle and prioritize.
Yeah. So when he gets back and he starts giving his boss the rundown of everything that went on, his boss was like, okay, that's enough now.
Well,
enough of this. Like, you guys are flying here, you're flying there, your hotel, man hours. Like, this is a gross waste of resources and you've gotten nowhere. Let's just get back to real work, shall we? Bob was like, what? Did you just hear anything that, like, I just said? Did you hear anything I just said?
Oh,
we're so close. But it didn't matter. His boss told him to back off.
Well, okay. Mm-hmm. No.
But no way he came this far to come this far.
No.
Bob kept going on the sly. He kept investigating.
Good.
On the DL.
Good job, Bob. Yeah.
Which I imagine is harder to do because he wasn't able to use the FBI resources. You know, we talked about doing things by the book, and like he's got a budget to travel or, you know, do this or that. But when you're working on the sly, he's like, you know, he knew with every fiber in his being that he was within arm's reach of something big.
Oh my gosh.
And boy, was he right. A call came in from an attorney in Ohio. The attorney was retained by a Michael Smith, John's brother.
Mm-hmm.
After all this time, it was too much. He needed to get something off his chest. But Michael wanted immunity. He would tell them everything, but he didn't want to be in trouble with the FBI.
Oh, man.
And the FBI said, go on then.
What a pickle. Mm. What a hard spot to be in for Michael.
Investigators went to meet with Michael again. And Michael took them back to November of 1974.
Oh.
That Thanksgiving, the family gathered at John and Michael's grandparents' house for dinner. It was days after Janice Hartman, John's first wife, had left him. But John seemed fine, you know. He was absent at times, though. There was a detached garage next to the house, and Michael saw a light on in there. And he went and found John sawing sheets of plywood.
Okay.
And he's making this box, like this large box. And he's like, what in the world are you doing? Like, can you imagine if we were at Thanksgiving dinner and someone was outside like sawing stuff? We'd be like, do you have to do this now?
I know. Like, can this wait?
We're about to have 4-layer pie. I'm about to pack like 3 of them to take home with me as well. Anyway, he was like, what in the world are you doing? Everyone's
come
like,
inside.
Everyone's inside. Yeah.
It's his family time.
And then he's like, what are you making? What is this? And John was like, well, you know, Janice left a bunch of stuff behind. And I'm making this box. I'm going to put all her stuff in it. And I'm just going to keep it.
Okay.
So this box was like 4 feet long. And why couldn't he just grab a cardboard box that was already assembled?
Seems
or three
easier.
Cardboard boxes.
Right.
To store all her stuff in. Why was he building a special box just for her stuff?
Mm-hmm.
You know, John was emotional as he was loading some of her things. You know, he was putting some of her clothes in the box, and then he put the lid on it and kind of put it on a shelf. And that was that. Michael was like, all right, can we get back inside now? We're about to watch the game, you know?
Yeah.
5 years passed before Michael saw that box again. 5 years!
Wait, okay. Was it sitting in the same spot?
It was in the garage the whole time.
Okay.
And he didn't question anything.
So 5 years passed.
5 years passed before Michael saw that box again, when his grandfather called him out to the garage and said, "Get your butt in here."
To Michael.
To Michael.
Okay.
When Michael entered the garage, there was the wooden box that John made sitting on the floor with the lid open. Inside was Janice's body.
Shut up.
He saw her face. He knew it was her.
What?
His grandfather looked at him in the eye and said, "Don't you dare breathe a word of this."
Why are you going to show him?
To your grandmother.
Oh, okay. At least to your grandmother.
Yeah. Well, he said nobody.
Well,
he
then said, don't show
tell
me.
Anybody about this, especially your grandmother, and get this thing out of my house.
He made him remove it. Oh my gosh.
Michael called John because he's like, "You need to come get this. Like, what even is this?"
No.
You're probably wondering, 5 years later, why would she still be recognizable?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
Okay. That's what Agent Hillen was thinking too. He was like, this sounds fanciful, made up.
Right.
Bob said, listen, okay, why don't you call John, tell him what you just told me? You know, I want to listen to your conversation about this supposed thing that happened way back in the day. Michael called John and told him, listen, investigators have been here multiple times now, and they will not leave me alone. They're getting too close to the truth. And he told John he was scared.
Mm-hmm.
Michael said, I'm not going to jail for you. I'm going to tell them everything.
Good for you, Michael.
That you built this box, that you put it in the garage, that Granddad opened it, and we saw Jan. And John starts laughing. Michael! He's like, okay, okay, I get it. But listen, that was a goat head. It was a joke.
No, I think I can
Someone
tell the difference.
Someone put a goat's head in there.
No.
And Michael was like, I saw her face. I saw her with my own eyes, John.
Oh.
He said, and her legs were cut off.
Those were not goat legs.
I saw her legs cut off.
Oh my gosh.
And John's like, okay, okay. You know what? I gotta go. This is silly. This is silliness. So back to the fact that these remains were recognizable 5 years after. Agent Hillen was like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, they would have been skeletonized.
Right.
There would have been a foul odor that, you know, got people's attention. Well, investigators learned that there was a funeral home adjacent to their grandparents' property. He grew up with a family friend that was a mortician.
Okay.
Did he have access to this funeral home? Was he taught how to embalm?
Mm-hmm.
It was a stretch, but it was too much of a coincidence to ignore. After all, Michael says he saw her face.
Right.
Well, they knew they needed to find this box, okay? But where was it? Bob and his team began sending out letters across the country to every county. And this was helped by Fran's family.
Okay.
Fran's family helped him with this list of places to send out these letters to. And basically the letter was like, have you ever seen a homemade box with human remains in it found in the late 70s, early 80s? Like,
riddle me this.
I know. It's just like, it was like some, this is going to sound crazy.
Yeah.
But now, while they waited to hear back from any of these county coroners or medical examiners, they got a phone call from Diane Smith, John's current wife, saying that John was missing.
Okay.
John's missing now.
Knew that was coming.
Okay. She said he went out one night and he just didn't come home. And at that point, he'd been gone a couple days. And they're like, well, crap. He's on the run again. Or maybe he was on his way up to kill his brother. We don't know. You know? Mm-hmm. Surprisingly, though, the next day, John came home. He was completely filthy, like he'd been digging in the dirt.
Okay.
Diane was like, where have you been and why are you dirty?
He didn't have a wallet. He left his wallet. He had no money. He came back dirty and he had a soda in his hand. How'd he get the soda? He said the FBI had him in a room. No, that was a long time ago that the FBI had him in a room. You know, nah, he was digging somewhere. And I think he was digging Fran's bones because that's his pattern. He kept the body for years and years of Jan. So why wouldn't he keep the body of Fran?
John's behavior was becoming more concerning.
I'd say. I mean,
Diane was like, okay, I think it's time we make our move. You know, she and Summer had devised a plan to serve John with annulment papers because remember, they had not been married that long.
Right.
And while he was at work. So they're like, we're going to serve him annulment papers while he's gone. They would already have the locks changed. They would already be holed up somewhere safely. Unfortunately, things didn't go to plan.
Oh, no.
Prior in the week, my mom was going to serve him the papers. And it was set up to where the judge was not supposed to serve him the papers until, like, I think 4 o'clock, maybe 3:30, 4:30. And so me and my mom took the day off of work. And because we knew John was at work. So we planned, we changed the locks. We hid our cars. So he didn't know we were there. So got the locks changed. We were going to gather up all our stuff. And I believe that's when we were going to go to the hotel. We're getting all that ready. I think we're gathering up our stuff. We're just like, you know, chilling. I think we had like an hour or two left. And he must have came to her work looking for her. And her work called her. I think that's how it happened. So anyways, we got to get going.
So for whatever reason, the judge served John's papers early. Maybe he was like, this guy. Stamp. Get him out of here, you know? Serve him already.
Why can't it just work?
I know. So Summer and Diane were still in the middle of packing their bags.
No.
You know, they thought they had time when they hear John's car pulling into the parking lot.
He had a monster Miata that has like super supercharged engine in this itty bitty Miata. So you could hear him coming up the road.
Now, they didn't panic right away.
He doesn't know we're here. Our stuff is, he can't get in. The locks are changed. Our cars are hidden. He has no idea we're here. That's why I was looking out the little peephole and I see him take the stairs. How I describe it every time, it's like Frankenstein. His face was super red, like super red. And he jolted up the steps like 2-3 at a time. And there was only probably about 10 or 11, 12 steps. And he started pounding on the window. And then he started pounding on the door. Diane, let me in. Diane, let me in. Now, he doesn't know I'm there. He only thinks my mom is there. I backed away and I went back into a kitchen where he couldn't. If you walk in the front door, you can't see me in the kitchen. My mom was over by the phone about ready to call the cops. We all thought he was going to break in through the window. No, he broke in through the front door. He was slamming his body up against the door. Like, and this is a skinny little dude. Like, his body was, you can hear it slam and slam and slam. And I'm in the kitchen. And we had these jars of candy. It was right there. I'm okay, that's what I'm going to hit him with. And we hear the door splinter. He comes in my view. And that's when my mom goes, I'm going to call the cops, John. But he had to have still been angry because he goes, oh, baby, he's, let's talk about this. I thought he was going to kill her until you saw me at the corner of your eye. And then my mom goes, you better run, you know, get out of here before I call the cops.
John was in a rage when he burst through that solid core exterior door to the apartment. And the minute he saw Summer there, he flipped a switch.
Whoa. to watch it happen in real time.
Right. And he just said, oh, let's just talk about it.
Whoa.
He was going to tear her apart.
Yeah, he was.
I've seen angry people before. I used to kick out drunk people out of a casino for a living. And I saw some angry people, angry, angry people. I have never seen someone like that before. When you see someone like that, that is the look of a killer. Like, I'll never forget it. And only certain people have seen that and lived.
While Summer and Diane were in hiding, Bob Hilland gets a phone call from a county in Indiana in response to one of his weird letters that he had to send out regarding those human remains in the box. Well, in the summer of 1980, some men were doing road work when they found this wooden box on the side of the road. And it was either nailed shut or it was screwed shut.
Hmm.
Either way, they had to really like work at it to get this box open, but they were going to crack it open and see what was going on in there.
Okay.
And they saw a skull with a rainbow looking a wig or hair. They didn't know.
Oh.
And they called the police. Whoever found the box back in the 1980s, it was an unidentified person. They didn't know who it was.
Okay, okay.
So they buried, you know, like they buried her.
They had it buried. Oh, yeah. Okay.
They buried her and they didn't have any. Oh. I don't know if they did an investigation to see if they could find out who it was, but it was the 80s. I mean, it's not like they had DNA. It wasn't right. Like social media. They're just, I mean, it was a different time, so... Maybe they did a little bit of investigating, but
like what can you do?
They couldn't find out who it was, so they just buried her.
Okay.
So now, present day, they compared the DNA from the human remains to Janice's brother, and it was Janice. They had found her.
Mm-hmm.
She had been stuffed into that box all those years ago, her legs cut off so that she'd fit in there. With this, finally... They had enough to arrest John.
Yeah.
And I think Diane and Summer felt like they could probably finally breathe at this point because they were going to take him down.
So when we went to the trial, we got to be there when they were doing their closing arguments. And that's when it was like a moment out of like Perry Mason. So they come out and they bring the box out that she was buried in. The box. And then they held up her gown that he covered her face and they held it up and you can see her face in her nightgown.
The makeup imprint from Janice's face was still visible on her nightgown that was in the box all those years later.
That breaks my heart.
And that rainbow hair, she had a pair of plaid pants that were stuffed in the box on top of her that had like bled into her hair.
Oh.
So that's what the rainbow looking thing was.
Okay.
That Michael remembers seeing, like he thought it was a clown wig or something like that. At that time, no murder charges for Fran were pursued and none of the information about her disappearance was allowed in the trial. It wasn't just a matter of, like you said, no body, no crime, but there was no evidence to even suggest that there was a crime. Any crime of any sort.
Yeah.
No evidence, no tangible thing, not one single thing to link him to Fran's disappearance. Fran's family attended the trial every day because, you know, even though they weren't getting justice for her, they had been so involved in.
Oh, yeah. I'd be sitting in the back going, but tell them about this.
Let me speak. I would have been like up there with my pencil skirt on.
Call me.
Yeah, working with the prosecutors. But they really fanned the flames in a lot of ways for the investigation. And that is what led to them finding Janice. It would have been nice to get justice for Fran's family as well, but the jury didn't need any more.
Yeah.
John, at 73 years old, was found guilty of Janice's murder and sentenced to life with the possibility of parole.
With the possibility of parole?
In 2019, John was actually indicted for Fran's murder.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know what they had. Like, I don't know what was presented that the DA was like, okay, here's an indictment. You know, we'll bring an indictment. The prosecutor's office knew that Fran's murder was going to be a tough one. It was going to be nearly impossible to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. They didn't have her body. They didn't have blood. But they decided to make a deal with John. Tell us where she is. Tell us what you did with her. And we'll drop the murder charges.
Drop the charge.
Yeah.
I mean, and I guess they talked to the family about this just to have closure.
They sure didn't. I mean, because
he's already... They didn't?
No. Well, John snapped their hand off before they could even change their minds. He told the prosecutors he wrapped Fran up in a blanket and threw her body into the dumpster outside of his work. That was it.
Whatever.
He gave no more details about how he killed her or how he got her body down 3 flights of stairs by himself without anyone seeing him do so. Fran's family and Agent Hilland don't believe he put her body in a dumpster at his work. Does that sound like something he would do? I mean, he was so careful for so long, and he's just going to dump her body in the dumpster behind a place he works? No.
Well, not just being careful, but he kept...
Yeah. He kept...
Jan's body. Exactly. Why wouldn't he keep Fran's?
That's it. And her family was not consulted before John was offered that deal.
That's gross.
It's hard to even call a deal, really, right. Because there was nothing in it for the state or the family. I mean, he obviously gave nothing of value to them, and now he can never be charged with her murder, and he never has to say anything ever again.
Well, I mean, I would say at least he's got a life sentence, but he has the possibility of parole.
Yeah, but he's old.
He's old, mm-hmm. But that's just so disappointing. And who are these other women? Who are these other women?
Right. Fran's body was never found and will likely... I mean, I hate to say never get answers for what happened to her, but he's the only one that knows.
I think for him to be able to get her down 3 flights of stairs, he had to have cut her up like he did Jan. But
How did no one see him hauling a box or a suitcase or... And that's the other thing, too. Think about the mortician that he knew.
Yeah.
Did he know how to drain bodies of blood? Is that why there was no blood in the apartment? Mm-hmm. They found no blood anywhere. Janice's body seemed to have been somewhat preserved.
Well, she didn't even make it to her doctor's appointment. Like, he probably thought, okay, hey, maybe he's taken her to her doctor's appointment. And that's when he did it. He had her downstairs already. I don't know.
That's a good one, Lena. It seems likely that he would have helped her down the stairs. But another thing was that, like, you're in a condo with... condos right next to you, condos below you, you're on the third floor, you have to pass all these doors to get down. Nobody remembers seeing them leave together.
Okay, but you just say, oh, I just threw her away. But did anybody ask why? Like, did it...
No, that's the thing, is he gave them virtually nothing in exchange for just...
To drop a murder charge.
Just to drop a murder charge.
It's mind-boggling to me that somebody could live their life with all of these secrets and pretend it didn't even happen. Sorry, go ahead.
As I was talking to Summer, she's like, how many other women were there?
Well, the pictures that she found.
Yeah, the pictures that she found. She's like, why hasn't anyone come forward and been like, oh my God, I dated that guy? Why? Maybe they're dead too.
You don't kill somebody in the 70s, kill somebody in the 90s, and you don't kill anybody in between. He's had many girlfriends. How many have left him that he killed?
What about Diane, though? Surely we can all agree that she is a victim in this as well.
Oh, yeah.
And Summer, too.
Absolutely.
I mean, I asked Summer how her mom was doing today.
She's fine. She just doesn't like to talk about it because they paint her out to be like a horrible person, you know, because she stayed with him. To this day, we are not considered victims.
And I wanted to know how Summer herself was doing, too, because I can't imagine having to go, you know, go through all of this, live through it.
Yeah.
And then just move on.
For years after that, I used to put my couch in front of my door for years and years and years. And just, I don't like answering my door. Thank God for Ring cameras because I can talk to them right there. Like, I ain't coming out.
You know, with time and distance from all this, I'm sure things have gotten better for Diane and Summer. I can't imagine what it's like to live through the trauma, you know, live with the trauma that comes with experiencing what they went through, having narrowly escaped the same fate that two other women that we know of before her did. To see the rage in someone's eyes, to have the door broken down.
Yeah. Knowing that he's already done this to someone else.
And he was going to lay hands on her and end her life. And then he saw Summer. Ugh. And he flipped a switch. Scary.
I mean, traumatic.
Yeah. She told me that every time she walks, like every time she used to walk past her front door, she would just feel sick. Like, and that's her front door.
Yeah.
And this is a front door that he has nothing to do with. It's true, just the fact of the front door that you have to walk by every day in and out. And she has to live with that, you know? Yeah. A huge thank you to Summer Hathaway for taking the time to speak with me. If you want to watch our full unedited interview, that's in two parts. If you're part of the fam, Patreon members can watch it now on our Patreon. There was so much we talked about that didn't make it into the episode for one reason or another, whether it was time or I couldn't fit it in. We talked about the fact that John had animated frog pornography on his computer.
Oh my. This.
Yeah.
This person.
Her mom found that and she was like, I don't know what to say.
people.
Right. So there was a lot we talked about.
There's so much wrong with this world.
Yeah. So if you're part of the fam, you can go watch that now. But.
Oh. Wow. Yeah. I'm so glad that she was willing to.
I know.
Have that discussion with you. I'm sure it wasn't easy to relive, as you know, absolutely. Sure. They were victims. They were traumatized and they had to live with it. I mean, being manipulated by this man, that's a lot.
I feel so bad for Jan's and Fran's family that they just have to, this guy that they're dealing with,
yeah,
it's like, he's a vault. And he's not going to tell them what he did with their loved one. You know, like, we have Janice's body, but like, how did he kill her? When did he kill her? Yeah. Like, what was...
What made you flip into a rage enough do that?
And then he cut her legs off and put her in the box. Like, this guy is unhinged.
Yeah.
So.
You're right. That was a wild ride. And yeah, it's a movie. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, and you can watch the Dateline episode. They had a lot more details about the investigation into Fran's disappearance and the trial and stuff like that. And I'll link that in the show notes. So,
well, you've already said a lot. You've told their stories eloquently, I think. It was, yeah. Thank you for telling their stories. Well, that was great. Let's do it again sometime.
Let's do it. See you later, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. Get connected with us by becoming a free member on our Patreon. Or for just $5 a month, you'll have access to bonus episodes, discussion groups, and much more. If you can't afford $5 a month, we get it. Inflation, am I right? Please consider leaving us a positive review and rating wherever you listen.
And don't forget merch. Support our podcast and show the love by sporting t-shirts with our latest designs, or grab an evidence bag to keep the chain of custody for all your valuables. Don't forget to follow our show on your favorite streaming app so you never miss an episode, and get photos and updates on our Instagram at Cousins on Crime Podcast or our Cousins on Crime Facebook page. Have a case suggestion? Email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com.